On the phone from Wellington, I have the New Zealand Greens co-leader Russell Norman to read his recent State of Our Planet speech and offer us a prognosis of the status of Mother Earth in these very crucial times. So, kia ora and good morning, Russell.
Good morning. How are you?
Very well, thank you, Russell. Russell, I congratulate you for coming to New Zealand to offer your skills and green credentials to the population at large. And so, how are you enjoying your calling to New Zealand?
I really love New Zealand. I mean, I've been here 10 or more years now, and my new role with being co-leader of the Green Party has been great. It's a real privilege actually to have that kind of role.
Very good, Russell. As your speech has covers about 45 minutes, is it okay if you gave your rendition of your original speech, The State of the Planet?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay, please feel free.
This is the third annual State of the Planet speech by the Green Party, and it's the first one I've delivered, and I call it Courage in Climate Change, and I delivered it on Waiheke Island in January 2007. It's great to be back on beautiful Waiheke. Now more than ever, we're living in a time when sustainability is vital. In 2007, we find ourselves living in a time in need of courage. We live in a time crying out for leaders who have the courage to face up to the incredible challenges confronting our world today. But instead, we find ourselves led at best by those like our government that is too frightened to do what needs to be done, and at worst, led by governments like that of President Bush, who cowardly attack some of the weakest nations on the planet in order to get their oil. We need the courage to face up to the truly sustainable nature of our economy and society, and the courage to change our ways. And we need governments that can provide leadership to the great green transformation that will have to happen if we are to live on the planet for the long term. And that's why we need the Green Party. 2006 will go down as the comeback year for the Green Party and the Green Movement. It was the year that the Green Party came back from the trials and tragedies of 2005. In 2005, we only just got over the 5% threshold in the election. We were largely cut out of government by Labor's dirty deal with Winston Peters and Peter Dunn. And then our much-loved and respected co-leader, Rod Donald, died suddenly in November. The Green Party took a few knocks, and we were grieving. But we have shown our resilience. Greens are people whose commitment to sustainability, justice, peace and democracy gives us the courage to speak the truth about the real state of the planet, even if it's a truth that is unpopular with those in power. There was no way the Green Party was going to give up, and we did not. And hence, in 2006, the Green Party surged back and retook its legitimate place at the centre of the democratic system. 2006 was the year in which some of the key issues that the Green Party has campaigned on long and hard finally started to receive the attention from the political system that they clearly deserve and desperately need, in particular climate change. This was a victory for both the broader Green Movement and the Green Party. The Greens are now firmly entrenched as New Zealand's third party, and we are ambitious to do even better than that, because we are ambitious for human beings to do a better job of looking after our planet and each other. And we are ambitious that life on this incredible planet of ours flourishes as best it might. And it's worth reminding ourselves just how incredible this planet really is. Planet Earth and all life on it, including humans, are recycled stardust. Most of the elements that make up planet Earth, including our very bodies, were formed in the nuclear cores of stars and then spread through the universe as dust when those stars burned out and or exploded. When we look up at the stars at night and wonder what it all means, we are looking at the kinds of places from which the very matter in our bodies originated. 4.5 billion years ago, the stardust and gas from around this part of the galaxy condensed to form our solar system. And our solar system isn't just any old solar system. It has a single magnificent star, the Sun, that, compared with other stars, provides us with a remarkably stable supply of energy and is long-lived, giving time for life to evolve on Earth. And our solar system, with its amazing giant planet Jupiter, that protects us from bombardment by comets and asteroids by acting as a huge gravitational vacuum cleaner. Had the Schumacher Levy 9 comet hit Earth instead of Jupiter on July 16, 1994, it would have all been over. The impact explosion was equivalent to 27 million Hiroshima bombs and left a mark on Jupiter the size of the Earth itself. And our solar system with our amazing planet Earth. Planet Earth, for nearly 4 billion years, an oasis of life in the solar system, and so far as we know, an oasis of life in the universe. Planet Earth, just the right distance from the sun. Any closer, and its life-giving water would boil off, and any further, and it would freeze up and be inaccessible. Planet Earth, with its swirling, molten metal core that produces a magnetic field that acts as a radiation shield and stops radiation from space frying the planet. Planet Earth, our only home. Life on Earth may have begun 4 billion years ago, but it was pretty much just bacteria until about 600 million years ago. Since then, there has been a vast, teeming proliferation of life of the most extraordinary and diverse kind. We have bacteria that lie dormant kilometres underground, and when you put them under a scanning electron microscope, bombarded with X-rays, they come to life before the very eyes of the scientists watching them. We have 750 species of fig trees, each in a symbiotic relationship with a corresponding species of fig wasp. We have the majestic and intelligent blue whale, the largest animal ever. And of course, in Aotearoa, New Zealand, we have the kingdom of the birds. The friendly pea waka waka, or fantail, the cheeky weka, the iconic tui, and the unlikely takahe. We've seen the emergence of the most marvellous kinds of plants and animals and all things in between. All these forms of life connected by sharing common ancestors and planet Earth. But the emergence of this great cacophony of life has been interrupted by five great mass extinction events, and great numbers of species were wiped out by natural causes. The last of these happened 65 million years ago, probably as a result of an asteroid getting past our protected planet Jupiter and slamming into Earth off the coast of modern-day Yucatan, Mexico. The dinosaurs were wiped out, and no animal larger than a cat survived on land. But now, 4.5 billion years after the formation of the planet, nearly 4 billion years since the emergence of life on Earth, after five major extinction events, a single species is responsible for much of the planet's destiny. A species that through the power of its technology, the sheer size of its biomass, its ever-expanding energy and resource requirements, has changed the course of our planet's history forever. And that species is, of course, us. The choices that we make now and in the future will have an effect on life on Earth just as great as that asteroid 65 million years ago. There is currently a rapid decline in the number of species on planet Earth as a result of human-caused habitat loss, the introduction of alien species, nutrient loading, the overexploitation of natural resources, pollution, and climate change. On our current course, we could lose a third of all species on Earth in the next 45 years. The United Nations Second Global Biodiversity Outlook report released last March found that we are now killing off species at 1,000 times the rate of natural selection. A new study in Science Journal this year predicted that all fish and seafood species could collapse by mid-century if current population decline continues. In New Zealand, our so-called sustainably managed fisheries have collapsed, such as the orange roughy and the hoki. The truth is that we are exterminating many species before we even know they exist. The UN Global Diversity Outlook warned us that, quote, in effect, we are currently responsible for the sixth major extinction event in the history of the Earth and the greatest since the dinosaurs disappeared 65 million years ago. But while this great extinction event may have started, its continuation is not inevitable if we address the causes. A number of leading biodiversity scientists published a plea for action in the Nature Journal in July. They said, and I quote, there is growing recognition that the diversity of life on Earth is an irreplaceable natural heritage crucial to human well-being. There is also clear scientific evidence that we are on the verge of a major biodiversity crisis. But despite this evidence, biodiversity is still consistently undervalued. There is an urgent need to bridge the gap between science and policy, they wrote. Economic policy in particular, I might add. There is still time to avoid this extinction event if we can bridge the gap between the scientific community and the policymakers. Outside the Green Movement and the scientific community, the churches are also speaking out about this biodiversity crisis. The Church of England has campaigned for some years now for governments to take the environment more seriously, and their 2005 publication, Sharing God's Planet, was a marker in the rise in environmental concern by mainstream religion. In the US, a group of evangelical church leaders has called on their government to take action on climate change and the biodiversity crisis. As well they might, because according to the Genesis in the Christian Bible, biodiversity is part of God's creation. And let me quote. And God said, "Let the waters bring forth abundantly the moving creature that hath life, and fowl that may fly above the earth in the open firmament of heaven. And God created great whales, and every living creature that moveth, which the waters brought forth abundantly after their kind, and every winged fowl after his kind. And God saw that it was good, and God blessed them, saying, Be fruitful and multiply, fill the waters in the seas, and let fowl multiply in the earth." Now, whether you are a believer or not, it is plain to see that the fish are no longer filling the waters of the seas. They are being plundered to the point of collapse. And every living creature is not being fruitful and multiplying. They are disappearing at a rate of at least 1,000 species a year. The Greens welcome the involvement of the religions of the world to help stop the massive extinction event that is now underway on planet Earth. The possibility of the churches, along with the indigenous people of the world, the Greens, the scientific community, and others campaigning together for biodiversity offers hope. One of the drivers of extinctions is climate change. In 2006, there was a lot of talk about climate change, but it has yet to be matched by action. But the need for this action is becoming more urgent and more desperate as the signs of accelerating climate change become apparent. For example, on December 29, 2006, scientists announced that a large ice island the size of a small city had broken off the Isles ice shelf in Canada's Arctic region. It is 37 metres high, 14 kilometres long and 5 kilometres wide. The Arctic expert Warwick Vincent of Laval University in Quebec said, "This is a dramatic and disturbing event. It shows that we are losing remarkable features of the Canadian North that have been in place for many thousands of years. We are crossing climate thresholds, and these may signal the onset of accelerated climate change ahead." He said Canada's remaining ice shelves were 90% smaller than when they were first discovered only 100 years ago. The issue is about feedback loops. Arctic sea ice is now melting rapidly as a result of positive feedback loops. As the ice melts, more dark seawater is exposed, which absorbs more heat, resulting in more sea ice melting. We won't have sea ice in the summer in the Arctic by the middle of this century, or even as soon as 2040, according to the latest report. That's only in 33 years. Another feedback loop that is heating the planet results from the release of methane frozen in the peat bogs of Siberia. In 2006, the peat bogs started bubbling furiously as the bogs melted and the methane came to the surface to enter the atmosphere. The amount of methane being released is so great that its global warming effect may be greater than the carbon dioxide emissions from the entire United States. We may have set off a chain reaction, leading to a catastrophic warming of the planet. Another feedback loop is that as the planet warms, it has less ability to absorb our carbon pollution. On land, there is a greater rate of organic decay in the soils, so they release more carbon dioxide. In the oceans, higher carbon dioxide concentration and warmer temperatures are inhibiting the ocean's ability to absorb even more carbon dioxide. When carbon dioxide dissolves in the ocean, it makes the sea more acidic, making it harder for the animals that use dissolved carbon to make their shells. The formation of these shells is part of the process of long-term storage of carbon, as these shells fall to the ocean floor when the animals die. And a NASA study released in December shows that the warmer areas of the ocean have lower phytoplankton productivity. So as the oceans warm, the phytoplankton are able to absorb less carbon dioxide, a classic positive feedback loop. And of course, phytoplankton are also the very foundation of the ocean food chain. And on top of this, the greenhouse emissions are increasing rapidly. 2007 may be the hottest year yet, as the arrival of El Niño adds to the long-term trend of warming. In New Zealand, we have seen a series of devastating flood events over the last few years, which are precisely the kind of events we can expect more of as climate change progresses. The Manawatu storms of February 2004 resulted in 2,300 homes being evacuated, 1,000 farms damaged, $300 million in damage, mostly uninsured. In the Bay of Plenty floods of July 2004, two people died, 3,200 evacuated their homes. The Bay of Plenty floods of May 2005 resulted in a $40 million bill for the government, 150 homes uninhabitable after floods and landslides. And in the September quarter of 2006, there was a big increase in local government expenditure on flood repairs, repairs that many local governments can ill afford. In the high wind and rain events of November, the Rakaia River reached 25,000 cubic metres per second, a 25-year high, and the wind gusted to 140 kilometres an hour at the Sky Tower, and it was evacuated. There are many more examples, but what matters is not one single event, but the overall pattern. The weather systems are changing as more energy is trapped in the climate system by the increased greenhouse effect. Professor Rapley of the British Antarctic Survey says, "What we are doing now to the Earth is unprecedented, so we cannot rule out the possibility that we will push the Earth into a domain where things will happen that have never happened before." And so we face a global crisis of epic proportions. But the world has faced crises before, and New Zealand provided the global lead out of one of the greatest crises of all, the Global Depression of the 1930s. And I believe that we can learn a lot from the courage shown by people at that time. This year will mark the 72nd anniversary of the election of Michael Joseph Savage and the first Labor government in 1935. The Savage government faced a global crisis of human misery and suffering that few had seen before. There was widespread poverty and hunger in New Zealand and around the world. The new government was elected on a platform of dealing with the depression and alleviating the misery and suffering. Savage and his finance minister, Walter Nash, instituted a series of measures that would later become known as Keynesian economics and the welfare state, but at that stage had no grandiose titles. They were measures invented to deal with the situation at hand by people who had the courage to think the unthinkable and try the untried, even though the powers that be said they could not. People were homeless, so the government started a massive program of state housing construction. People were without work, so the government started a policy of indigenous industrial development and large-scale relief work was organised. The international market was driving down dairy prices, so the government helped them work together to form a monopoly export desk. The 40-hour week was introduced, unemployment and other benefits were introduced or increased. These policies started to alleviate the suffering. But when Walter Nash, the finance minister, went to Britain in 1939, in an attempt to renegotiate the loans that New Zealand had with the banks in Britain, he was given lectures by the governor of the Bank of England and the Treasury officials on the foolhardiness of his economic and social policies. Like the IMF and the World Bank of our time, they were determined to teach New Zealand a lesson for adopting unorthodox policies. They refused to extend the loans unless the government changed its policies, but Savage and Nash doggedly refused to sell out and buckle under pressure. Eventually, the New Zealand government won, and after the war, their kinds of policies, and policies like Roosevelt's New Deal in the United States, became orthodox Keynesian economics. Michael Joseph Savage had the courage and determination to challenge the international economic orthodoxy in order to overcome the social crisis of the Great Depression. He did not abolish the market, but changed the way it worked to make it socially sustainable. They did not abolish the market system, but placed rules on it and replaced dog-eat-dog with opportunities for underdogs. They created a world in which people like my father, from a poor background, had the opportunity to get an education and become an engineer. They created a world in which people like John Key could gain access to decent, affordable housing, health and education so that he had the opportunity to follow his dreams, whatever one may think of the morality of currency trading and financial speculation. And as we face the current social and environmental crisis that is climate change and biodiversity collapse, we once again need to reform our market system and introduce rules on it so that we don't destroy the very environmental foundation of our civilization. We need the same courage as Michael Savage to challenge the economic orthodoxy of our day. Just as there was a Keynesian economic transformation in the 1930s and 1940s in New Zealand and the world, now, in the early part of the 21st century, we need a green economic transformation to change the way our market system works. Fundamental to the green economic transformation is the idea that the world is finite. It has finite resources for us to use and finite capacity to absorb our waste, including our carbon dioxide and methane waste. Our current economic system is based on the idea of endless exponential growth in the consumption of material resources, and it has led us to consume resources and produce waste at a much greater rate than the planet can sustain. We are not living off the interest of the natural capital of the world. We are consuming our capital. We all now know that we are killing the golden goose. The ability of the planet to support us is being compromised by ever-increasing material consumption. We must place a rapidly sinking cap on the amount of carbon dioxide and methane that we release into the atmosphere. We must place a sinking cap on the amount of nitrogen released into our waterways. As a society, we must find the courage to act in our own enlightened self-interest, even if powerful vested interests say that we must not. We need to reduce our oil addiction, an oil addiction that cripples our trade deficit, adds to climate change, and makes us complicit in the war for oil in Iraq. We know that people around the country are starting to understand the problem and are willing to make some changes in their lives. A recent New Zealand Herald survey found 3 in 4 people believed they needed to make lifestyle changes to reduce global warming. 2/3 had installed energy-efficient light bulbs in their home, or more than half had cut down on car use. 2 in 5 people had switched to a more fuel-efficient car. The rise in petrol prices has played a part in the behaviour change, but many people are ready and willing to make changes to save our common future. While people may be starting to make their own changes in their lives, it requires government intervention to set rules across the board throughout the economy. Most of all, we need some kind of price put on carbon emissions. How can we get the market system to internalise the cost of carbon emissions if we don't put a price on it? The carbon pollution charge was meant to do this, but Michael Cohen and Treasury sank it in December 2005, with the credit being given to Winston Peters and Peter Dunne as part of the post-election deal. The truth is that Treasury had already written the paper sinking the carbon pollution charge, and Labor went along with it, with National cheering from the sidelines. And like an increasing number of environmental and social issues, if we are to deal with climate change, we will need the courage to face down the World Trade Organization. Just as the Savage government helped to transform the international finance system, so we need to work to transform the international economic institutions of our age, such as the World Trade Organization, if we are to combat climate change and biodiversity collapse. Some of the measures needed to combat climate change may be incompatible with the WTO. For example, the European Union is currently looking at introducing a border tax against energy-intensive goods coming from countries that have not made commitments to reduce their greenhouse emissions. After all, why should European companies internalize the cost of greenhouse emissions while American companies continue to pollute for free? If American companies can get away with polluting the planet for free, then what's to stop European companies moving to the US and simply exporting their products into Europe? Hence, they need a climate-protecting border tax to even up the playing field. But even such a climate border tax may be against the rules of the WTO as a restriction on trade. We need a government that has the courage to say to the WTO that it must change if it stands in the way of measures to combat climate change. But instead, we have a government that bends over backwards to accommodate the WTO. We have a government that says there is no contradiction between the WTO and saving the environment. Yet the latest decision of the WTO on genetic engineering says that trade trumps the precautionary principle when it comes to genetically engineered food. The US, Canada and Argentina took a WTO case against Europe because the European authorities didn't approve GE food for consumption fast enough. Many European countries and citizens were rightly worried about the health implications of novel GE food. The WTO decision, released in September, was that the Europeans had an illegal anti-free trade restriction on the importation of GE food. It said the Europeans did not have the right to block GE food under WTO rules. Now, there is an international treaty that gives nations the right to refuse entry of genetically modified organisms on the grounds of the precautionary principle, It's called the Cartagena Biosafety Protocol, and Europe has ratified it. But the WTO rejected this treaty as the basis for Europe to refuse GE food because the US had not ratified the Cartagena Protocol. The WTO overruled a treaty established to protect the environment and human health in the name of free trade. This does not bode well for attempts to introduce measures to protect the climate under the Kyoto Protocol, another environmental treaty that the US has not ratified. The WTO tells us that it must carry out a careful balancing between the interests of trade on the one hand and human and environmental well-being on the other. This was illustrated neatly in an earlier WTO case where they ruled that the Europeans could not stop the import of meat injected with growth hormone that was illegal to use in Europe because it caused cancer. In that case, the WTO said that the WTO treaties reflected, and here I quote, a delicate and carefully negotiated balance between the sometimes competing interests of promoting international trade and of protecting the life and health of human beings. Now, it must be a tough job at the WTO, balancing promoting trade on the one hand and human life on the other. I wonder how you make that kind of choice. Well, here's some beef grown with chemicals that cause cancer, and here's a law that restricts trade by banning this beef from entering Europe. Which one should I choose? George Michael would say choose life, but no, the bureaucrats working in secret in the bowels of the WTO had to weigh up human life and free trade, and they chose trade. The WTO isn't the only organisation riding roughshod over democracy and the environment. The North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, has clauses to protect investors from, quote, expropriation. So when the Mexican state of San Luis Potosí refused permission for a US company to put a toxic waste dump on a site that would contaminate their local water supply, the company took the Mexican government to court because they had been, quote, unquote, expropriated. And they won compensation of US $16 million from the Mexican government because they had lost their toxic waste dump. In a current case, a US investor has given notice of his intention to sue the Canadian government for US $350 million because the investor was not allowed to use its artificial lake as a waste disposal site after the province of Ontario changed the law to make it illegal to use lakes, including artificial lakes, as waste disposal sites. There are a large number of these cases heading to court or in court. Of course, our government is very keen on signing up to a trade deal with the US, a deal that, if it included provisions like NAFTA, would result in very similar cases. So while our government says that trade deals are compatible with protecting the environment, even though the evidence is to the contrary, what they really mean is that trade deals come first and the environment comes second. This is not a courageous government willing to face the realities of climate change. This is not a government that will say, if the WTO is getting in the way of saving the environment, the WTO must change or it must go. This is a timid government, frightened of doing what is right. Now, while the WTO may be one of the great institutions of the world economy in need of reform, there is another great economic institution whose major role is to make sure that the fossil fuel resources of the world are kept safe and sound. And that economic institution is called the US military. The job of the US military is to secure the world's oil reserves for the United States so that the US, that great oil junkie, never misses out on its daily fix of 20 million barrels of oil. They told us that the US military was paying a visit to Iraq to help out with some human rights violations that had been detected there. Or was it to find some of the weapons of mass destruction that the West had sold Saddam Hussein, whose payments were overdue? Or was it because Saddam did 9/11? Never mind, it's hard to keep track. Of course, we were told it was nothing to do with the third largest reserves of oil in the world, which just happened to be found in Iraq. Tony Blair said so in 2003 when he said, oil revenues, which people falsely claim we want to seize, should be put in a trust fund for the Iraqi people, quote unquote. And George W. Bush said so in June 2006 when he said, oil belongs to the Iraqi people. The government has to be good stewards of that valuable asset. And former US Secretary of State Colin Powell, that great liberal, said so in July 2003 when he said, the oil of the Iraqi people is their wealth. We did not invade Iraq for oil. But now it seems that the US puppet regime in Iraq is about to pass a new law that will give foreign oil companies the right to exploit the Iraqi oil reserves. The new law will give foreign oil companies 30-year contracts to extract crude oil in Iraq, for the first time since the Iraqi oil industry was nationalised in 1972. It would also allow Shell, BP, Exxon and all the rest to pocket up to three-quarters of the profits from the oil. Unsurprisingly, major oil companies have had lobbying teams in Iraq over the last few months while the new law has been negotiated. It seems that Blair and Bush may have been wide of the mark, but US Vice President Dick Cheney was more on the money when he said in 1999, and I quote, "By 2010, we will need a further 50 million barrels a day. The Middle East, with two-thirds of the oil and the lowest cost, is still where the prize lies." And what a cost for those that stand in the way of that prize. At least 218,000 Iraqis, and probably more like 650,000 Iraqis, have died or been killed since the second invasion of Iraq. We live in an age in which the greatest superpower the world has ever seen seems to exist in a moral vacuum. The Bush administration has no moral compass to orient itself in the world. It has embarked on a crusade against the Middle East driven by no moral code but by a search for oil. The neoconservatives in Washington said they did it to impose US-style democracy, but only so long as the Iraqis agreed with what the US wanted, which of course is no democracy at all. For the first time in the history of the United States, in 2003, they found themselves in control of an Arab capital city. And what did they do to it? They let mobs loot all of the major institutions of Baghdad. The Ministry of Education and the Ministry of Agriculture were destroyed. The museum holding some of the oldest antiquities of human civilization dating back to the ancient Mesopotamian world were destroyed and looted, while the greatest army in the world stood by and did nothing. The one government department that the US protected was the oil ministry. And of course, the US protected and controlled the oil fields. And they want the oil in order to maintain the last remaining sense of purpose of the American Empire, consumption. Just like the Roman Empire before it, the moral emptiness of this Bush regime is papered over by endless growth in consumption. There may be no democracy in the Middle East. There may be thousands locked up in the US gulags in Guantanamo Bay and Abu Ghraib, but you can at least afford to drive a Hummer, an SUV the size of a small tank, down the streets of Los Angeles. I would ask you to pause just for a moment to consider the moral compass of an administration that goes to war in the Middle East time after time, that kills literally hundreds of thousands of people in order that Americans can afford to drive a massive military vehicle, the Hummer, around the suburbs of their cities and towns. Where is the moral compass that drops cluster bombs into the suburbs of Baghdad that literally blow children's brains out just to keep hold of the oil? A government that twice bombs the offices of Arab television station Al Jazeera, once in Kabul and once in Baghdad, presumably because Al Jazeera is not on message like the rest of the embedded media. This US administration has lost its way. It has lost its moral compass and has become an empire in search of the resources to maintain its reckless consumption in a world running out of resources and a world desperately in need of moral leadership to confront the greatest global challenge we have ever known in the form of human-induced climate change. And the Australian and British Prime Ministers, John Howard and Tony Blair, who follow the lead of the American Empire, who have swallowed each of George Bush's lies and replicated them around the world, remember the weapons of mass destruction that did not exist, remember the role of Saddam in 9/11 that never was. How much moral courage did it take to enforce a decade of sanctions against Iraq that led to the death of over 500,000 children, while the vile Iraqi leadership continued to enjoy the high life, funded in part with bribes from Howard's own Australian Wheat Board? Howard and Blair, who followed the lead of the former US Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, who, when asked whether the loss of 500,000 children's lives under the sanctions was worth it, said yes, it was worth it. Sanctions that were so diabolical that two UN humanitarian coordinators quit over them, and one of them, Dennis Halliday, said when he left, quote, "I've been using the word genocide because this is a deliberate policy to destroy the people of Iraq. I'm afraid I have no other view." Howard and Blair, who set their moral compass by pointing it at George Bush and Donald Rumsfeld. But we in New Zealand are not immune from what Borat rightly called this war of terror. While we did not join the coalition of the killing and the illegal invasion of Iraq, we have our troops in there. We have had our troops in there since, and more importantly, the US spy base at Waihopai, shrouded in secrecy but involved in spying for the US military, plays a key role in the global war of terror. And on top of that, we are dependent on the cheap oil flowing out of the Middle East like everyone else. We didn't go to war, but we are addicted to oil, just like the rest. The Swedish government made a decision that it didn't want to be addicted to oil and has made a commitment to reduce its oil dependence. The Swedish Commission for Oil Independence, a government commission headed by the former Prime Minister, released its report on making Sweden an oil-free society in June 2006. Their reasons for seeking oil independence were instructive. Firstly, they wanted to reduce their economic exposure to the inevitably long-term increases in oil prices. Secondly, they wanted to reduce their dependence on a resource that caused so much war and suffering. Thirdly, they wanted to utilize their own natural energy sources. And finally, they wanted to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. We cannot separate ourselves from the US war for oil in the Middle East until we reduce our oil addiction. We cannot cut our greenhouse gas emissions until we reduce our oil dependence. And we cannot reduce our out-of-control trade deficit until we cut our oil imports, the cost of which will only increase in time as the world runs out of cheap oil. Our major use of oil is for transport, but we can cut our oil use dramatically by using a combination of renewable biofuels, the introduction of plug-in hybrid cars that can be charged in the electricity grid overnight, increasing vehicle fuel efficiency, greater use of rail and shipping for freight, and greater use of public transport for passengers. We can introduce vehicle registration fees linked to fuel efficiency to reward those with fuel-efficient cars. With our massive wood resources, we are in an ideal position to lead the way in the research of converting woody biomass into ethanol and, according to a recent Royal Society research paper, replacing all our petrol needs with ethanol derived from wood. The Labor government is proposing to give out $1 billion in company tax cuts without any consideration to linking these to green tax changes. We could use the tax system to provide incentives for increased fuel efficiency in car fleets or the conversion of engines to the use of biofuel and other measures to reduce greenhouse emissions. This is a great opportunity missed. The trouble is that it's a done deal. We can increase public transport use by investing heavily in the public transport system. This combines fairness and sustainability because an affordable, efficient public transport system enables everyone to get around when the price of petrol goes up again, as it inevitably will. I need hardly remind you that the Labor government, like almost every other party except the Greens, is obsessed with roads and is making little investment in public transport systems compared to roads. And we need an investment in the IT infrastructure so that people can meet virtually and work from a distance rather than having to travel. All of these things are possible in New Zealand if we had the political will to do it. Labor are possibly proposing to do some of it in a half-hearted kind of way, but hardly enough to result in a plateau in our use of oil, let alone decreasing our oil use. This is not an evil government, but it is a timid government. It's frightened of doing what needs to be done on climate change. At a time when we need the courage and vision of a Michael Joseph Savage, we have a government of the meek. We have thousands of pages of drafts and consultation documents, but after 7 years of Labor-led government, we have precious little action on climate change. This is a government that is still too scared to tell Mighty River Power, a state-owned enterprise, that they cannot build their new coal-fired power station near Whangarei. And Labor is the best of the bunch. So in order to help give the other parties a bit of a friendly push along, today we're launching our climate change scorecard on the performance of the parliamentary parties on facing up to the challenge of climate change. This is a snapshot of other parties' climate change policies, and we will update it regularly. It is not a pretty record, but there has been progress. Most of the other parties in Parliament have finally admitted that human-induced climate change is real. Labor, after much dithering and changing of its mind, finally seems to be using the resources of government to develop some draft policy. But it still lacks urgency, and it will mean that we will not meet our Kyoto commitments to cut our emissions to 1990 levels by 2012 without purchasing carbon credits on the international market at considerable cost. The Māori Party recognises that the solution to climate change is not just about changing energy sources, but also about changing our consumption behaviour. They have a big picture understanding, but at this stage, little explicit policy. The National Party has only recently emerged from the climate change denial swamp, but at least it has emerged. National still has a tendency to be destructive rather than constructive in its approach. It doesn't have a lot of its own ideas beyond its yet-to-be-defined emissions trading scheme in the electricity sector and giving carbon credits to foresters, but we hope they do better. New Zealand First recognises the reality of human-induced climate change but thinks that planting trees will be sufficient to deal with it, which it won't be, and has consistently opposed the carbon pollution charge. Late last year, United Future finally pulled together a policy on climate change with some ideas picked up from elsewhere, which is a start. Unfortunately, they still oppose a carbon pollution charge and are not fully committed to the Kyoto Climate Protection Treaty. ACT are still in denial and hardly warrant a mention. You'll see that Labor does the best out of Labor and National, but we are hoping that National will clean up their act and provide a bit of competition. It would give us a lot of pleasure to see National and Labor compete on climate change policy with each other and indeed with the Greens. The Greens don't get 100% on this scorecard either. We've been leading the debate, but we don't have all the answers. We put forward a pretty comprehensive plan in our Turn Down the Heat document released in March 2006, some of which was picked up by other parties, which was great. We put forward a series of six private members' bills that addressed six different dimensions of reducing our greenhouse emissions and future-proofing our economy. We put those forward in November, but they have yet to be pulled from the ballot in Parliament. We want to engage further with other parties, with civil society and with developments overseas. In particular, we need more answers to deal with emissions from agriculture, though organics can play some role. One of the criteria we used in assessing other parties' climate policies was whether the policy was fair. If we are to get community buy-in to the changes needed to save the planet, then the policies must be fair. For example, it is unfair simply to hand out permits to pollute to the existing electricity generators who produce carbon dioxide. They should be made to pay for at least part of their pollution to create an economic incentive to cut their emissions and to reward those generators that do not pollute. And the income stream gathered by the government in selling off carbon permits should be used to fund schemes that cut the cost to those who can least afford it. We need a massive investment in home insulation so that houses don't need lots of external heating and cooling. Insulation reduces energy use and makes houses warmer and healthier. We need massive investment in our public transport system so that people have real alternatives to taking the car. Otherwise, climate charges just become another charge on those who can least afford it, without giving them any new choices. Overall, what comes through on this scorecard is the lack of urgency. Most of the other parties share the government's mania for road building, a fetish about GDP growth, and a fear of reducing the greenhouse emissions from the sacred dairy cow. And these fears, fetishes, and manias get in the way of dealing with the most important issue facing the human race: human-induced climate change. Martin Luther King said, "Cowardice asks the question, is it safe? Expedience asks the question, is it politic? And vanity asks the question, is it popular? But conscience asks the question, is it right? And there comes a time when one must take a position that is neither safe, nor politic, nor popular, but he must do it because conscience tells him it is right." We stand at a moment in the history of our species and our planet when we must act on climate change because it is right to do so. It would be immoral for us to steal from our children by polluting their atmosphere. It would be immoral of us to keep wiping out the species of the world so that our children inherit the sixth great extinction event. People everywhere are waking up to the urgency of climate change. People care about their children and want them to inherit a world of abundance. And people are becoming more and more interconnected in this increasingly small planet of ours and demanding action. there is a great wave of an alternative globalisation, a people's globalisation. This wave will sweep over the political system and break over the heads of the tired old parties and the old ways of doing things. Some say that there is only one superpower left in the world, but I say there is another great superpower on the rise, and it is people, it is people, it is people.